Italy.
Patrice. Bernie shrugs. She fell in love. Happens to all of us. He nods over at Patrice with a wry smile. At one time or another.
Then where'd she go, eh?
She leans in, rests an elbow on her knee.
When she died, we hadn't talked to her in almost a year. She was mad at me.
She straightens her collar.
I didn't want her to move away. Her life was here.
She grew up, you know. That's what kids do.
Bernie rolled his eyes in Patrice's direction, and she sat back, her rump, against the couch cushion.
I just wanted her to keep her life. She wanted a new, big, fancy life. She didn't have to stop speaking to me.
She turns and levels her gaze at me.
That's my regret. We weren't on speaking terms.
When she died, we didn't know she was in the city. She died in Midtown.
Midtown? Who goes to Midtown? What was she doing, seeing a show?
Bernie shakes his head. And she was alone. Her husband didn't even know she was here. No one knew why. It was the damnedest thing.
Out of character, too. We've never been able to figure it out. She was a little anxious, you know?
Patrice tilts her chin at me like I should know this, like maybe I was anxious, too.
She took medication, but it was getting better. She was coming out of her shell. We thought marriage would be good for her at first. Even in high school, she was a homebody.
She shakes her head. It's my one regret in my whole life.
Patrice. Bernie's tone is pained.
Patrice stands up. The sofa cushion inflates with a sigh. She waves her hand behind her in my general direction, a motion of apology, and sways out of the room. I hear her heavy footsteps on the carpeted stairs. Bernie lets out a large belly sigh, mops his brow with a handkerchief from his pocket.
I'm sorry. We're mostly okay. You're just so...
He examines my face like the words are written there.
Unexpected.
He stands up and looks at me sadly.
We were old parents. I regret that. We tried for years to have babies, almost a decade. Had a lot of miscarriages. No one could tell us why. It wrecked Patrice, wrecked her. Joni was our saving grace, it seemed. We maybe protected her too much because of it.
I thought of Evelyn and nodded.
You should go, honey. Listen, leave your number. I'll have Pat call you when she gets her strength back.
He stands up, the couch permanently molded into the shapes of their bodies. I pictured them there, night after night, in a darkened living room with nothing but a flickering television to cover the silence. I scribble my cell phone number on the back of an old lottery ticket that he gives me. He takes it and sets it on the television stand, which is just an old wooden box television with a flat gray screen. He walks me to the door, pats me awkwardly on the back. He holds up one wide pink hand, hold on a moment, and ambles down the hall. A moment later, he comes back.
Here, you can keep this. We have tons of them.
He hands me a small laminated card. The front has a picture of Joni in front of a library. A short floral dress, a smile filled with endless summers and infinite possibilities.
It could have been me.
The back of the card has a prayer.
That's her college graduation.
His hand shakes, a violent tremor, and he shoves it in his pocket.
She went to Queens College, library science major. You know the trip was an hour and a half one way? 3 transfers. Does that sound like someone with anxiety to you?
I shake my head.
You understand.
It's hard. His eyes are watery gray, without any distinct color, and up close his neck wobbles. I know. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to spring this on you. I didn't know about Joni. He coughs, thick and mucousy from the back of his throat. Then he says something surprisingly empathetic.
You've lost someone, too. You just didn't know it.
I don't tell him I've lost a lot of people I didn't know about in the past few days. I reach up and kiss his cheek, and leave him there, patting his jowl. Once outside, I call a car service. I stand on the corner, a half block away from the Bascio residence. Someone keeps parting the curtains in the front window of the closest house. I half expect a police car to show up because I'm a suspicious person. I text Cash while I'm waiting. Joni is dead. Joan Bascio. Find out all you can. She was married. Find out who. Before I can think it through, I dial Lydia. She picks up on a half ring, her voice high and echoing like in an airplane hangar. Zoe? There is a loud commotion behind her, a crash followed by a deep voice, almost in a yell. I'm here. Are you okay? What's wrong? My heart picks up speed. We've been vandalized. Everything is ruined. There's a loud rustle like she's turned her face away from the speaker, the scrape of her chin against the mouthpiece. What? I wait a beat, but there's silence, then talking. Lyd, where are you? The shop. I have to go. We have to call the police. I'll call you back. Is everyone okay? I ask, panicked, my brain sifting through everything that's happened and settling with a heavy, foggy dread on the idea that I'm involved. This has everything to do with me. It's all connected. I think so, she replies. I'm in Brooklyn. Apropos of nothing. It'll take me a few. I'll be there as soon as I can. My brain is white hot. My hands shake as I hang up and dial Cash. I tell him about the shop. Come with me? I hate to ask him another favor. He doesn't hesitate. I'll meet you there. I meet Cash outside Le Fleur de Lys and survey the damage from the street. The storefront windows are smashed in, the glass splintered inward toward a single point, as though hit with a heavy object. I step over the pieces in the doorway. Inside, the exposed bulbs in the ceiling are broken. Shards of glass screwed into fixtures are all that remain. The glass counter has been crushed, the refrigerator door hangs off its hinges, the arrangements inside have been ripped apart and flower heads scattered around the floor, which is wet with large puddles. The water buckets have all been upended.
2 weddings worth of inventory gone, Elisa laments as I come through the door.
She stands up when she sees me and crosses the room. Her spindly arms fold around me in a limp, defeated hug. Javi works the broom in the corner, pushing all the glass and floral carcasses to a sopping pile in the center of the room, and then looks at it impotently, like, now what? Lydia hovers in the doorway, a drooping amaryllis dangling between her fingers. The counter in front, next to the register, is heavy, stainless steel, meant to be a table for last-minute arrangements and trimming if necessary. It's more functional than aesthetic. The top is etched with a thinly carved message. A message that is meant for me. I feel it in my bones, heavy and leaded. I run my fingers over the metal. Jared. The ugly word is scrawled with a dull straight edge. Words carved into metal are violent by nature. The message is practically irrelevant. The letters themselves are sinister, the way magazine clippings pasted on paper are indicative of ransom notes. But this note is meant for me, in a way Lydia or Javi or Elisa could never know. The small D hovers slightly lower than the rest of his name. It's the brand inside Rosie's mouth, that deliberate small D clinging to the corner of the E. The blood rushes to my head. I feel at once hot and sick. A sheen of sweat coats my arms, and I feel it down my spine below my bra strap. One single drip of fluid tracing lazily down my backbone. I sway, and from what sounds like the inside of a tunnel, Cash yells, "Catch her!" But I don't remember anything else. Chapter 23 The first person I see when I open my eyes is Officer Yates, her rounded dark eyes, long lashes, bright lipstick. My first thought is, why am I sleeping at the shop? Elisa peers over Yates' shoulder, her face a mask of concern mixed with something else. Anger? Latent impatience at the very least? I forget, then remember, seemingly at the same time. How long was I out? I sit up, but feel sick and sink into the velvet-covered pink office chair that has been brought over just for me.
No more than a minute.
Cash is on one knee next to the chair, leaning close. The smell of his aftershave turns my stomach.
I just got here, Yates offers.
Elisa brings me water, and I can't help but enjoy it, just a little. Elisa waiting on me. Elisa, who once sent me to Duane Reade to buy a pencil sharpener. Twice, because it's apparently possible to buy the wrong kind. Yates stands up and motions everyone back, long nails flickering.
Give her some space, okay? Let me talk to her.
They disperse. Javi pouts with his broom, pushing it insolently into corners. Elisa pretends to flip through paperwork. Yates pats my hand while I ask her about the man at the back door. She has a report from the night before she wants me to sign.
I'm sorry we can't do more, there's just nothing to investigate.
She raises her eyebrows and all I see is doubt. Cash overhears and chimes in.
I was there. I saw the same thing Zoe did. There was someone at that back door. The door handle jiggled.
I believe you.
She pats Cash on the shoulder, placating. It's just no use. The word resources bounces around in my mind.
What about Jared Pritchett? Did you look him up?
I press my left palm onto hers so our hands make a sandwich and close my eyes. A chill goes up my spine like the trill of a xylophone. Mick Flannery exists. This is all connected. Do you believe me now?
I do. I did before, but this helps.
She waves her arm around the mess and smiles a little, unexpectedly, flashing a nicotine-stained incisor at me.
I have ideas, though. Give me time, okay? I believe you. I do.
I looked up your testimony.
This was some heavy shit, girl. Those kinds of crime rings are not run by one or two people. It's usually more like 30, 50.
This? She motions toward the counter, the mess.
This is revenge. Pure, simple. To terrify you.
Then what? Kill me?
My mind flashes back to the stripped-down van, that bloodstain, that child's lacy sock. My stomach roils.
Zoe, there are officers stationed at your apartment. We'll protect you.
I need to call Henry.
My tongue feels coated in sawdust.
Do you have a place to go?
I look at Elisa, Javi, Lydia. They all blink at me, silent. Then, Lydia nods her head, just once.
Yes. That won't be necessary.
Henry stands in the doorway of the shop, his hands on his hips. At the sight of him, my chest pops with relief. He looks like hell. His hair is disheveled, his face is red on one side like he's been sleeping on it. I push up off the chair and I'm across the room in seconds. I stand in front of him, unsure, until he pulls me against his chest, which feels foreign and familiar at the same time.
You're here. How? I didn't even have time to call you.
Zoe, I tried to call you about 10 times. You tell me someone is chasing you, and then I hear nothing back, except you stayed at Lydia's.
He surveys the room and sees Elisa and gives her a nod of recognition. Lydia opens her mouth to protest and then closes it, shakes her head, keeping the secret.
I half thought she'd blurt it out right there. Zoe didn't stay with me.
Despite our gulf, she keeps it. Yates pulls me away from Henry, and I realize the refrigerator still hums in the corner, spitting out cold air through the broken glass. My arms gooseflesh.
Zoe, listen to me. I need you to be careful, do you understand me? You can't go back to your apartment. We'll put you under surveillance. Come to the station.
Yes, I say automatically.
Not an option. I'm getting her out of here.
Henry crosses his arms over his chest. This is his Henry pose, the one I've seen at parties, where most men relax, hold a drink, let their arms drape around a woman's shoulders. Henry stands like he is keeping guard.
He himself is a counter-argument.
His hand on pink spandex. His eyes flick to Cash, cold and dismissive. His expression, tight eyebrows, slightly turned chin, say, "We have things to discuss." I wonder, then, if he will bring an agenda. He turns to Yates.
Is she done?
Yates nods.
Technically, yes, for now. I think it's best that you stay at a hotel somewhere in the city.
Yes, I understand that.
Henry holds his arm out toward me. I know he's thinking of Fishing Lake. My mind spins.
She needs to stay close by, Mr. Whittaker.
Yates's voice is stern, in a way I've never heard another person talk to him. This is an active investigation. We need to be able to get a hold of Zoe.
Yes, officer, I understand that. I have a house about an hour away.
He's resolute, and Yates pushes her mouth together, her arms on her hips, her starched blue uniform gapping in the chest. Her broad shoulders rival Henry's, and she looks at him just as determined.
I'd advise to keep her here, she demands. I've never seen anything like it.
Henry, the house won't be safe, I interject, playing peacekeeper.
It's all right, darling. I've got security coming. I just need to arrange it.
He holds up a hand in Yates's direction and mollifies.
Just find this Jared person. I want this bastard caught.
He herds me into the street, swooped and protective, so I don't even have time to say goodbye to Lydia, Javi, and Elisa, or thank you to Cash. He ushers me into the back of a car, and we're in the street headed downtown before I can think. What could possibly be the connection between Caroline, Joan, and Jared? What happened to Mick? How does he fit into all of this? I trace back Evelyn's relationship with Mick in my mind, their meeting at the beach, his seemingly random disappearances. What is his connection to Caroline? I try to connect these dots, but pain pulses a quick beat behind my eyes. Henry pats my hand the whole car ride, as though it's a pet. I want to tell him to stop, but I can't find the words. The sun hangs low in the sky, slung between buildings, orange and bright. Within minutes, we're in the Lincoln Tunnel, speeding to safety. Henry the hero. I check my phone to make sure it's on. Waiting, waiting. As we speed through the tunnel, the side lights flickering past the window remind me of a searchlight, seeking out lost, drifting ships. Seeking. Seeking something. I touch my finger to the glass. Chapter 24. By the time we get to the house, evening has fallen, quiet and thick. The sky is blue-gray, clouds covering the stars, and in the country so much emptier than twilight in the city. Henry lets us in, and the air smells freshly laundered, clean and safe, the innocence of dryer sheets. The kitchen contains a cold spread, cheese and hummus, fresh vegetables so crisp I find myself looking around for Penny, who couldn't have left more than moments ago. There's no one, of course. It wasn't that long ago that I found this sort of convenient arrangement of our lives to be charming, like a party card trick. A sleight of hand here, a simple misdirection there, and voila, here's your dinner. Now it crawls under my skin and festers there like a chigger, and the whole thing makes me itch. Henry makes me tea, chamomile, lightly sweetened with honey that he insists on serving me in bed against my protest. It's barely 8 o'clock, for God's sake. My head feels so heavy, and I want to do nothing but sleep.
You must be exhausted. Please, let me take care of you.
He pulls the covers up to my lap, fluffs my pillows. His hair is flopping down on his forehead, and he's changed into a dark Oxford shirt and khaki shorts. He looks relaxed, nurturing, his eyebrows pulled together in concern. He keeps kissing me, my forehead, my hands, my cheeks.
As you are woman, so be lovely.
He brings me a hot washcloth for my headache. He brushes my hair, kneads my back, his thumbs working the tender muscles between my shoulder blades. I let him. His hands guide me back down to the bed, lying on my back, and his fingers work the buttons on my blouse. I close my eyes and let him remove my clothes until the breeze blows in, chilling my skin where he's kissed it. His fingers trace circles around my belly, my thighs, my breasts, and I let him. They find me open and wet between my legs, and I let him. I feel loosely disconnected, lubricated at the joints, floating above the bed, watching now naked Henry make love to me. Slow, insistent, loving. His face flickers in the light of a candle I don't remember lighting, and it embodies one word. Rapture. I don't come. I feel numb and weightless, like I've had too much to drink, or like I've taken something. A thought pops in my head but flitters out before I can catch it. Henry shudders and bucks. His soft yelps in my ear remind me of a caged puppy, and he whispers things I can't quite hear. Except one.
My most precious thing. He says it again and again until I fall asleep, hard, like falling off a cliff.
I dream of Evelyn, her teeth bared, red and bloody. She screeches, "What have you done?" She comes at me, hands clawed out to attack my neck, my throat. I can feel her nails on my neck, my collarbone, scratching, and she shrieks like a banshee, her hair wild. Her hatred is so real, so palpable, that I wake up wrapped in sheets, soaked with sweat. Henry isn't in bed. It's 2 a.m. I roam the house and find him sitting in the kitchen, sipping bourbon. He leads me back upstairs, changes the sheets, and tucks me in. I sink into the freshly made bed. I'm quite sure I can't handle even one more little thing. Henry's quiet care is such a relief. He brings me orange juice. "For strength," he whispers, and I drink it gratefully, chugging it in large, heaving gulps. "Have you heard from Yates?" I ask. "Did they find him? Can we go home?" He shakes his head and I flop back against the pillows, exhausted. I'm asleep in no time, a thick wool sleep, heavy and dense. The kind where, when you wake up, you don't know if it's morning or night, and the numbers on the clock swim around, bumping into each other. I don't have any dreams. I wake sometime later. Could have been hours, could have been days. I'm feverish and chattering. Henry, bedside, tucks thick patterned quilts around me, murmuring about germs and summer colds. Fluffing pillows, clucking and puttering around the room like a nursemaid, picking random objects up and moving them for no other reason than to have something to do. I push myself up on my elbows, watching him. "Have they found him?" Henry shakes his head.
"Just worry about getting better."
He kisses my forehead, his hand cupping the back of my neck. He brings me more tea, toast, and Penny's buttery, flaky scones. I wonder when she made them, and feel a sharp beat of unexplained hatred. I leave them all on the tray untouched. On the nightstand, he sets down a tall tumbler of orange juice.
"You have to stay hydrated or you'll only get more sick."
I chug it down and fall back to sleep, the kind of thick sleep you fall in and out of quickly, dreamless. He wakes me every few hours to drink, until I shove the glass away. I can't remember Henry ever taking care of me sick. Prior to today, I wouldn't have imagined it. I can't drink any more orange juice. Henry, I think we need to go back to the city.
We will. We will, as soon as I know it's safe.
He pushes my hair off my forehead, which is slick with sweat. Yates should have called by now. Did she call? I try to get out of bed, but my vision swims. I have a fever, and I thunk back onto the bed.
It's the flu. Your fever was up to 104.
Henry speaks in hushed tones like we're in hospice.
I've called the doctor and had something delivered. It's an antiviral. It will help, but it might make you vomit.
He's asking my permission in the way Henry asks permission, which is to not ask at all. He's telling me permission. He brings me two small pale pink tablets and a large glass of water. I chug them down. I pull the blankets in against my face. I imagine the sheet getting sucked into my mouth, cutting off my oxygen. I hear Henry's footsteps on the floor, the quiet creak of the door. And only when I'm sure I'm alone do I drift off to sleep. When I wake up, the bedside table holds a full glass of juice and a note. "Be back soon, Henry." On the chaise lounge, he'd laid out my clothes, a gentle nudge to get up. Get dressed. A purple t-shirt and a pair of white shorts, like maybe today we would just go hiking.
Hiking.
I dump the juice in the toilet and get dressed under self-protest. I have to fight every movement to not crawl back under the blankets. I'm so cold. But underneath some layer of hopelessness flames primal anger, a spark off a flint. Everyone seems content to just let Jared come to me. Yates seemed blasé about it. Henry was no help. If no one is going to help me, I'm going to have to help myself. If I could reach Cash, he'd surely do some investigating. I need help. Joni's death, Caroline's threat, Jared, the vanishing Mick,
It's all related somehow, I just can't find the link. Every single thing is connected. My whole body vibrates, that's how confident I am. I'm right that Jared and Mick and Joni's death are connected, that it's somehow my fault. That I killed my sister. I have a sudden thought. If I find the missing Mick, I can unravel this whole thing. I make my way downstairs to the kitchen, looking for my phone. My blood is pumping now, thumping through my veins in a steady rhythm. Find Mick. Find Mick. A drumbeat of redemption with a touch of revenge. I still feel foggy and weak from the fever, and my stomach turns with nausea from the antivirals. But the anger perches right under my skin and could easily fan to full flame. I searched the kitchen, the sitting room, and the sunroom, pulling out drawers and cabinets along the way. No phone. I head back upstairs and sift through the drawers in our dressers, suitcases, pants pockets. No phone. It was right on the bedside table when I fell asleep. I was sure of it. It has to be somewhere. I have an idea. Henry's office. In Henry's office, I yank open desk drawers and flip through files. In the closet, I find file boxes and dig through them, finding nothing notable save for a small padlock key that I slip in my pocket. On the bookshelf, my eyes settle on the picture of me in the woods, that day on a picnic. I realize I'm wearing the same shirt I have on. I pick up the picture and study it, and my hand goes to my collar, feeling along the ribbed edge of the crew neck. I touch the shirt in the picture. A smooth hem in a deep V. A hint of cleavage, a shadowy swell of breast. It's not the same shirt. I only have one, purchased as a gift from my darling husband, in a color I've never liked. I study the picture closer. The same uneven eyebrows, the slight widow's peak at my hairline, my dark hair newly grown, shiny and soft to my shoulders. The mole at my left ear. My left ear. My hand flies to my face, gently tapping the mole near my right ear. The woman in the picture is not me. Chapter 25. I fish the key out of my pocket and slide it into the padlock. The locked room. The room filled with files and personal effects that Henry wanted protected when he rented the place out. The room I've never seen. With the picture tucked under my arm, I turn the key and the lock pops open. It takes me a minute to dislodge the latch, and the door gives with a stutter catch. The room is pitch black and it's only 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I realize there are room-darkening shades on the windows. I flip on the light. On the far wall, file boxes are stacked 5 across, 4 high, identical, and unlabeled. The wall on the left contains large crates. The wall on the right is covered by a large sheet. The room smells musty, unused. I pull the picture out and examine it again, tilting it one way, then the other in the light. There are subtle differences. She has a chipped front tooth, barely noticeable. She has a red slivery scar across her collarbone. Had I not been looking for something, I wouldn't have seen it. My hands shake. I pull down the top box, anchor it on the floor, and lift the lid. Files. I flip through them. Terra taxes. Terra student loans 2007. I pull down the next box. More files. Then the next. Until all the boxes are scattered around me. What am I looking for? I don't know. There's only one explanation for the picture. I just need proof. Bingo. Wedding pictures. I flip open the album and fan the pages. Tara in an ivory fishtail gown, her hair pulled back in a chignon, smiling a smile I recognize as my own, the same smile I've given to Henry. A secret smile. A lover's smile. Lips half parted, turned up on one side. I turn the pages with my thumb, one after the other. A wedding with no guests. A lavish dinner spread, a glistening pile of scallops. Tara's mouth opened goofily to eat one. I hate scallops. Through my husband's old wedding photos, I learn that my dead sister liked seafood. A first dance, an intimate restaurant, a single violinist.
Oh, Joni, why were you so isolated from the world?
Did she have friends? Did her parents want to come? Where was this wedding? I examined the pages, twice, front to back, then back to front, looking for clues but finding nothing.
She looked so happy, so gloriously no-strings-attached happy, the way dogs and toddlers are happy, with abandon.
I set the book down, move to the large crates and unfold the flaps. Inside, neatly folded, are clothes, piles of slacks, blouses, dresses, fabric so fine you wanted to bury your face in it. I look at the labels. Versace, Donna Karan, silk, velvet, cashmere, varying shades of purple. I think of all the clothing he's given me. Eggplant, violet, lavender, a color I abhorred my whole life.
Tara's favorite color.
He didn't buy me new clothes. He gave me her clothes. My mouth tastes like copper and I suck air through my teeth. I can't catch my breath. I've been nothing more than a fucking Barbie doll. I stand up, cross the room, and rip the sheet off the wall. Underneath, 100 little pictures flutter. A corkboard mounted to the wall is pinned with pictures, articles, scribbled notes, sheets of loose leaf, random pieces of paper. One side of the board is labeled Tara in thick magic marker, the other side is labeled Hillary. The blood thunders in my ears. Pictures of me at the flower shop, lace skirts and fishnet stockings and combat boots as I arrived at work, or stiletto heels as I left for the night. Lydia and me laughing, holding our sides, sharing a cigarette. The pictures of Tara are wide-ranging. Early shots show her with long flowing hair, younger, freer, with pink cheeks and loose, open smiles. Later, she is guarded, as though she was holding a secret, thin-lipped and a bashful look away, more enigmatic. In some cases, all the more beautiful. Her eyes are darker, hooded. I tug down a newspaper article, pulling the paper through the pushpin and ripping the top. September 5th, 2011. A woman, 25, was killed in a hit-and-run at the corner of 32nd and 6th. The victim is identified as Tara Joan Whitaker. I smooth the article out with my hand, leaving ink smudges across the paper. There it is. Confirmation. Proof. Tara and Joni were the same person. I lurch forward, grab a box with both hands, and heave. I feel like I'm going to be sick. The nausea rolls through me. I put the box aside. Tacked to the board is a thick ecru card. I pull it down and examine it. The front simply says, Hal. Inside, eerily familiar handwriting loops around a just-as-familiar poetic verse. As you are woman, so be lovely. As you are lovely, so be various. Merciful as constant, constant as various. So be mine, as I yours forever. I turn the card over. On the back is another verse. Lovely I am, merciful I shall prove. Woman I am, constant as various. Not marble-hearted, but your own true love. Give me an equal kiss, as I kiss you. A laugh-sob gets caught in my throat. This was Tara, subtly telling Henry, I know you. I see through you. He'd never gotten it, of course. For all Henry's intellectual prowess, I should have known he would never indulge in something as frivolous as poetry. My sister, with her mystery novels, her introversion, and her crippling agoraphobia. She may have been timid, but she would never be mistaken for stupid. Not marble-hearted, but your own true love. Galatea telling Pygmalion that she is more than his creation. She's her own living, breathing soul. Give me an equal kiss. Is Henry capable of considering a woman his equal? Clever girl. There's a picture pinned, Tara and Henry in front of the Eiffel Tower, and I flip it over. TJ and Hal, honeymoon 2008. She's wearing a black dress with a large silver rose pinned to the collar.
black and white striped skirt. I recognize it. I wore it in France right down to the brooch. My mouth tastes like pennies and my hands shake. All these pictures, her wide, happy smiles, free of anxiety. Certainly outside in public, in crowds. Not agoraphobic, then. All dated 2008, 2009, a few from 2010, nothing from 2011. Like she'd simply disappeared in the year between 2010 and 2011. Even if she'd struggled with anxiety, as Mrs. Bascio suggested, she wasn't homebound. She was functioning. Oh, Joni, what did he do to you? I feel it, then, the pressure of what being Henry Whittaker's wife would eventually do to me. And it's as heavy as a house, perched right on my chest. I pull down the other articles on my side of the corkboard, small typeset blotter notes from the trial, witnesses and defendants, Jared Pritchett and Michael Flannery. It's right there in black and white. It suddenly occurs to me that I'm in danger. In what way exactly, I'm not certain. I cannot be found in this room. I push my hand against my forehead. I need to leave this place. How? I pin the articles back to the board, restack the boxes, close up the crates. I take one last look around at this shrine. It's been right under my nose the whole time, like he'd wanted me to find it. I feel the sob catch in my chest. My whole life is a lie. This whole room is a lie. I back out of the door, slam the padlock back together, and rush to Henry's office. I slide the keys back into the box in his closet, and I hope I remember the right one. I realize I left the picture in his secret room. No time. I race to the front door. I need to leave. Call for help. Something. I try to imagine explaining all this to Yates. She'll lock me up, straitjacket and all. I realize I have no car. Think. I'll walk to the corner store. And then what? Call who? Is there even an information to call anymore? I think of Trisha with her chipmunk cheek grin and her shiny, excited eyes. I imagine clawing at her to call the police, gasping and panicked. It'd be the most exciting thing to happen in Fishing Lake since the Italian witch lived up the hill. I turn the handle on the front door and pull. It's locked. I flip the deadbolt. Try again. Locked. The door doesn't budge. My heart is starting to pound. Bad things are going to happen. I can feel it. The panic crawls up my spine and wraps around my neck, and I can feel the back of my head starting to sweat, big fat drops dripping down my neck. My life unraveling at my feet, and I'm left stumbling and tripping over the threads. I turn the deadbolt and the door lock and give a swift tug. Nothing moves. The fear rises up, choking and tearing at my throat until I can't breathe, and I cough a sob against my forearm. The door is locked from the outside. I'm locked in. I rest my forehead against the glass and take deep breaths, trying to calm down. Windows, that's all, windows. You can't really lock a person in a whole house. I don't care if I have to rappel the wall. The claustrophobia is setting in fast and I can't catch my breath. In, out, in, out.
Going somewhere?
I whip around and there stands Henry. Tall, familiar-looking Henry, with his vacation smile and tousled hair. A soft fraternity boy curl falling down onto his forehead. His head cocked to the side, his eyes marble-like, little rat beads of eyes. I push my back up against the door, the knob digging into the small of my back. In his left hand, he's holding a gun. Chapter 26 He leads me gently to the bedroom. His soft, manicured hand resting on my elbow, almost caring if it weren't for the hard metal of the muzzle pressed up against my spine. He urges me onto the bed, and I resist with a look, and he sighs.
You've always been obstinate.
He shakes his head with a small smile the way I imagine mothers react to strong-willed four-year-olds, like my resistance is infantile, cute. My tongue tastes like sulfur. He jabs the gun farther into my skin, pulling my arm behind me and giving it a solid twist.
Get on the bed, Zoe. I could kill you right now. Who would care anyway? It's not like you have anyone.
He says it off the cuff, chillingly calculating. He shoves me face first onto the bed and grabs my left wrist. In one smooth motion, he handcuffs me to the iron headboard. He pulls on my arm, checking to make sure it will hold.
So, Joni is Tara.
No point in beating around the bush. My heart thumps in my throat, but my head remains clear, maybe for the first time in weeks.
Then who am I to you?
His back is to me, and he's fiddling with something on the dresser. He turns then, holding a filled syringe.
You're my replacement. Do the math, Zoe. When did Tara die?
My mind spins on dates and facts that up to this point I'd only been peripherally aware of. 3 years ago. I swallow hard but say nothing. He doesn't wait for me to answer.
And when did your Jared get out of prison?
I have no idea. I shake my head. He gives me a pitying look.
Tara was so much smarter than you. It's a shame, really, for so many reasons.
Sigh.
I'll give you a hint. It's 3 years ago.
My stomach seizes, and I feel the sweat on my upper lip. I lick the corners of my mouth, but my tongue is as dry as sandpaper.
Is that why they're back now?
My voice is a rasp.
What people? The people you screwed over back when you were living a disgusting life, selling drugs on playgrounds?
Henry chuckles softly and shakes his head, tapping the bubbles out of the syringe.
No one is back now. I found Jared and killed him 2 years ago because the police were incompetent, and I realized it was you he wanted. He didn't know Tara existed. Biggest mistake of his life, I'd say.
His mouth twisted once, a sideways kiss.
Mick died of a drug overdose in witness protection years ago.
Witness protection? This is why there was no Mick. Wait, you killed Jared? I stare at him. This man, this elegant manicured man, my husband, who likes lamb only on Wednesdays and thinks that Cabernet should never be drunk with pasta because they are both too heavy. He is a murderer. It's inconceivable.
Don't be so shocked, Zoe. He's not the first. He's not the last. No one will miss him either. Just like they won't miss you.
He flicks the syringe once more with his finger and walks slowly toward the bed. I inch backward.
It actually wasn't even hard. He's not that smart.
But if there is no Jared and Mick is dead, you were doing these things? The vandalism, the break-in? My voice hitches to a screech. Technically, I am the reason my sister is dead. Technically, Jared killed her, but only because he thought she was me. My life, my choices, my mistakes. A simple case of mistaken identity, that's what set this ball in motion. Jared was coming back for me, a revenge plot for bringing down his house of cards. Henry only continued what Jared started, after, of course, he killed him.
Do you think I got to where I am by chance, Zoe? That my money, my life, my position is all a happy accident? Truthfully, you've tired me out.
I don't know what that means, I hiss it out between my teeth, kicking my foot in his direction.
Tara used to just sit in the house and read. You? You're out of control, running all over Manhattan, following me to the gym?
I must look shocked at this because he half laughs.
I know every move you make. Your phone, the apartment, with technology it's so easy now. GPS, cameras the size of thumbnails. How do you think I found you at Elisa's? I know all about your dates with that little reporter, even the little sleepover that you lied about. Every keystroke on the computer has been recorded, everything you've done since you've lived in my home, Zoe.
Who's the girl at the gym? I spit. He shrugs.
She's nobody.
He means it, too. She is nobody to him. Caroline? The phone call. That was you, too? I try to sit up, but my arm flails, shackled above my head, and I can't get purchase on the bed. He stands over me with a faint, icy smile.
You're just so out of control all the time, Zoe. You don't listen to me, you don't need me, not the way Tara needed me. Tara was sweet, compliant, she needed me. You are defiant, unlovable. You're just so fucking unlovable.
His voice is low and the words pierce my heart. He could be right.
You're indifferent to me, Zoe. I can't have that. It was different before, with your blissful ignorance, but you had to push, seek her out, find Caroline, then your sister. You ruined everything, not me. You're never content.
His hand grips my knee, and I open my eyes. He slides the needle into my thigh and depresses the plunger. I gasp. What are you doing, Henry?
You didn't just owe me a wife, Zoe. You owed me Tara. Do you see now?
His face is inches away from mine, and I can see all the pores in his skin. His breathing comes in quick rasps. He fades from view, and the room wavers and spins. When I wake up, the room is dark. The clock on the dresser blinks 2 a.m. I sit up, and my arm shoots through with pain. It is numb and buzzing cold. In the dark, I hear the rustle of sheets next to me. Henry.
I can't feel my arm, I mumble groggily, and Henry flicks on the light.
I realize I've been dressed in a white silk nightgown and robe that isn't mine. It looks like a bridal negligee. I can't lift my arms, my legs. I need to get out of here. Henry, clad in pajama bottoms and a t-shirt, holds a small key. Deftly, he lifts my arm, pinning it against the wall while he unlocks the handcuffs and switches them. In the brief second the handcuffs are off, I make a clumsy attempt to flail, softly fobbing him in the cheek. He slaps me, hard. My face beats a steady, hot pain, and my eyes water.
Do it again, Zoe, and I'll kill you right now, he spits at me.
Then his expression sags, my sleepiness softening the edges of his face. I try to focus my eyes on Henry, who is splitting and coming back together again and again. It reminds me of watching Evelyn's old television when she worked nights, scrambled softcore porn channels, a flash of skin here or there, maybe a blinking technicolor breast. I close my eyes, yellow spots and flashes of color. When I open my eyes again, Henry is standing in front of me, naked, erect, cupping his penis. His hands move and slide up my thighs. I turn my face away, and he pulls me back by my chin. I realize that I'm naked under the negligee, and I kick my feet. I struggle to sit up.
No,
I mumble. The drugs are wearing off, I think. The no sounds clearer to me, but I can't tell.
Settle, my love.
Sometime in the last few minutes, he's lit candles, turned off the lights. He lies on top of me, kissing my neck, and I push against his chest.
God damn it, Zoe, just for once, be compliant.
He stands up hastily, embarrassed, slapping at his thigh, at his flaccid failure.
This has never happened before.
He's both apologetic and accusing. His eyes shine with hatred, and he hovers over me until I think he might hit me, his fist clenched, knuckles white. I set my jaw, prepare for the punch, and close my eyes. He turns away and dons his pajama bottoms. When he turns back, he's holding a syringe. A quick pinch in my other thigh, and my vision swims. He brings me trays of food, and I become fixated on the clock each time I'm awake. 6:27 a.m., 4:13 p.m., 5:42 a.m. I try to track the days, but I keep losing count and have to start over. I give up trying to remember, and with my free hand press my thumbnail into the skin along my hip bone until it comes away tinged pink with blood. One half moon for each day. Or what I think is a day. Sometimes it's hard to remember if it was a.m. or p.m. when I woke last, and therefore has it been a day or 12 hours? I can pass my index finger over the healing lines, feel the scabs, and count. Sometimes when I bolt awake, panicked and gasping, I feel for these small incisions. 6.
I've been here 6 days, then 8, then 10. I think he dresses me in Tara's clothes, black cocktail dresses and silk pantsuits. Where would an agoraphobic wear pantsuits? He walks me to the bathroom, 2, maybe 3 times a day, handcuffed with the steel tip of the gun in my back, and then plank walks me back to bed. Then he props me up, feeds me crackers and juice, talks to me, tells me about his day. His words float around, echoing as though he's in an airplane hangar. If I say what too many times, he gets angry. I wonder what he wants with me. Will I just be here forever? His replacement, Tara, chained to the bed like an animal? Will I die here? Will anyone miss me? Does anyone care? A shot to the leg. I barely feel it. I've started getting sick, throwing up, hot green bile on the bed, which makes Henry furiously angry.
What will you do with me? I ask him weakly, a long string of spit trailing from my mouth.
I'm lying on my side, my face sweating. Whatever he's injecting me with, it's too much. My body has started to reject it. It's making me nauseated and weak. I will die here in this isolated house in clothes that are not mine. He's toweling up my filth, and he smiles, a clever, Henry-ish smile.
Yates called me, said she's been trying to call you. I said you'd left me. You were staying at a hotel in the city, and I didn't know which one. She said she had news on Mick, so I'm guessing she's discovered his death. A shockingly good detective for a woman. He was living under a different name. Witsek, you know.
He says all this conversationally as he works at a stubborn sticky spot on the bare mattress.
After you left town, he turned state's witness, brought down the whole organization. He did a very small amount of prison time, then went into witness protection. I figured it out easily enough, but then again, I'm fairly well connected. The feds, they don't talk much to the police.
My head feels heavy, and I let it sink down to my arm, my face wet with tears, sweat, maybe spit. I am starting to stink.
But what will you do with me? I ask again, dumbly, not knowing if he'd even answered the question or not.
We have 3 months until hunting season. See, you'll come back to me then, realize your mistake, how much you've missed me. You're all alone in the world, Zoe. You have no one. You only have me. You leave your hotel, come back here to beg for my forgiveness. You try to find me in the woods behind the house, as a surprise.
His voice has lowered to a whisper, his finger caressing my cheek.
I'll think I've hit a deer. It's tragic, really.
Henry, people will look for me. Officer Yates, Lydia, Cash. Someone will wonder. You can't get away with this.
Tara never thought I was stupid, Zoe. But you question me at every turn?
Honestly, it's so infuriating. He says this conversationally.
I asked Yates to pass it along to Cash and Lydia. We had a rather heated conversation about your past, your secrets. I told her everything, your drug pushing, Evelyn. You are not the person everyone thinks you are.
He purrs in my ear.
You just want to be left alone. You're afraid. You've run away again.
He walks over to the dresser, picks up a wad of cash, waves it in my face.
You've even taken some of my money.
I had shared different pieces of my story with different people, but no one knew the whole thing. Cash knew the most. He wouldn't be deterred. But he would go to Yates first. After her talk with Henry, she'd assume I'd stolen Henry's money and skipped town. Henry lies on the bed, curled into me, his breath hot and wet on my neck, and I want to kick him away, but I can't make my legs cooperate.
3 months. He's going to keep me here for 3 months. I'll die first.
I wake up covered in urine. I smell it before I feel it. Henry is ripping the sheets from underneath me, and I tumble against my cuffed wrist, shearing the skin until the blood runs down my arm, which enrages him even more.
He is angry, yelling words I can't understand. The sheets come away piss yellow and red. He rips off my underpants and nightgown, feels along my hip, those crusty ridges. He asks me, "What the fuck is this?"
I answer him, "It's my clock."
I don't think it through, it just comes out, and not even coherent. I can't even be sure of what I say, it sounds garbled. All he hears is, "Clock." He marches to the dresser, rips the clock cord out of the wall, and slams the door behind him. With my free hand, I feel along my naked hip.
12 days. I've been here 12 days.
I think he leaves the house during the day. I force myself awake, hear the door slam, the car slide down the driveway. I scream for as long as I can. I imagine Trisha from the market down the road in a little pink warm-up suit, shiny and metallic-looking, a bright purple sweatband, new sneakers, trekking past the house on a power walk, trying for the last time to lose the baby weight. I scream for Trisha. I scream until my voice gives out and I am weak, hoarse. I scream all day. Or at least what I think is all day. I scream until Henry comes home.
Sun up, sun down. Faint lights through the curtains, switch arms, a sponge bath. His hands roam my naked body, but he can't keep it up, so he gives up. More foreign clothing, tracksuits and gym clothes, baggy and falling off. I'm wasting away. I'd rather just starve to death. That will come faster than 3 months, surely.
I got you a present.
A smaller syringe, a faint yellow liquid.
It won't make you sick.
He smiles. This is my present, a drug that will kill me slower. I need to do something.
Henry, wait. Hal.
I recall the name on the back of the picture, Hal and TJ. My voice is thick, molasses-coated, stuck like tar on my tongue. I feel the edge of my dress, a summer garden dress, fit for bridal and baby showers, sweet-smelling perfume and flutes of champagne. Pizzelles. Where did that come from? I remember my sister's picture, smiling in front of the library on her college graduation day. A flower dress.
What?
He stands at the foot of the bed, his fingers tapping against my bare foot impatiently. I struggle to sit up. Between doses, I retain a shocking amount of lucidity. Like the drug doesn't so much seep from my system as much as it dumps out, the fog lifting like a heavy stage curtain.
Hal, I repeat.
Don't call me that.
His eyes narrow, his wrist holding the syringe flicks.
Why? Isn't it what you want?
I inch forward, suddenly sure-footed, steady. I reach out, the handcuff pulling against my skin like a vice, and I touch his arm. It's warm under my fingertips, and I close my eyes, remembering when, not that long ago, I would have made this gesture sincerely, loving. The flat bones in his wrist are unyielding. He meets my gaze and falters.
Let me try.
I see him consider this. I see him think about me, in her clothes, reading Ruth Rendell and Sherlock Holmes in peep-toe bedroom slippers and calling him Hal. Picnics in the woods, patiently waiting in our towering apartment for him to arrive home, excited to see him, jumping up, wrapping my legs around his waist. A lifetime of missionary positions and dinners determined by what Henry ate for lunch, or what day of the week it is. Me. Being content with this, obedient, compliant. He wavers. I see it in the way the syringe wobbles in his hand.
Hal?
I say it again, but softer, coy, and I avert my gaze.
The Muir.
How I would act if I were truly submissive. Try to channel this twin intuition I've seen on Oprah. Even think for a crazy second if she can see me or hear me.
Give me a goddamn sign, Joni. What would you do?
What if I could do this? We could be happy, couldn't we? We were once, right? Remember the day in the woods? The picnic? I wore that purple shirt. We made love against the tree.
I take a chance here,
remembering the force at which he pushed me against that tree, the bark gouging into the soft skin on my back. I think back through our marriage. All the moments of the high